Chapter 12, Let's Talk Turkey by Willie Snow Etheridge. 12, My Day with Mrs. Dorr. While in Ankara, I had a day with Mrs. Russell Dorr, the tall, handsome, 40-ish wife of our ECA director for Turkey. For 8 hours, she showed me how life is lived by her and some of the Turks around Ankara. And no matter what else might be said about it, it is a busy life. With a Turkish ECA assistant driving us and a Turkish woman, also, I believe, in ECA, keeping us company, we were headed toward the country to visit what Mrs. Dorr called a typical Anatolian village, and she ought to know, for she prides herself on getting out among the people. Why come to a foreign land if you're going to sit around with other Americans chatting about how things are back home? She demanded, eyeing me rather challengingly with her big brown eyes. Why not stay in the United States if you're so fond of home? As for me, I go into the villages, talk with the peasant women in their houses, and invite them to visit me in my house. And once some came, which shocked my American friends. A goodly distance out in the country, we arrived at a group of bleak mud dwellings stacked against bare, hard hillsides. A sign said this was Ravli, but why Ravli wanted anyone to know it was Ravli was beyond me. It was the dreariest place I ever saw. Not a tree except in the valley between the hills, where a few puny willows grew beside a trickle of a stream. As we got out of the car, a swarthy, middle-aged man in patched clothes sauntered up and eyed us suspiciously. Mrs. Dorr greeted him brightly in English, but he did not greet her back. It was painfully evident that we were not wanted. The Turkish ECA assistant began to converse with him in low tones. Something was seriously amiss. We stood about first on one foot and then on the other. In front of us was a narrow rocky street snaking up the slope between a few houses. Innumerable pies of dung were plastered against the mud walls and on the ground to harden in the sun. They use it for fuel, Mrs. Dorr murmured as she saw me looking at it. They have very little wood here on the plateau of Anatolia, so they have to save every ounce of dung for fuel. It's too bad, too, for of course it would make excellent fertilizer for the worn-out land. Curiously enough, it was one of these very stacks of dung that were the cause of our surly welcome. Easing close to Mrs. Dorr, the ECA assistant whispered that the spokesman for the village had told me that the peasants here had decided to allow no more visitors because their last visitors had insulted them. We had asked if the rounds of dung were the rolls of cheese that they ate. The remark was surely communist-inspired, the assistant and Mrs. Dorr agreed. It was calculated to make the villagers dissatisfied with their lot. Understandably, the villagers decided to keep all visitors out from then on, the assistant said. But I explained to the spokesman that you are Mrs. Dorr, the wife of the ECA director, and he has agreed to show us about. Mrs. Dorr was touched. She poured out a speech for the assistant to interpret. How grateful she was, how honored, how happy. Slowly, we climbed the hill until we came to the home of the spokesman. In front of the door, a young boy was sitting on a sheep, shearing it. We stepped as warily as possible around the wool. An old, roly-poly, sharp-eyed woman greeted us. She wore a voluminous navy blue cotton print wrapper, much parched over slim trousers. Her feet were bare, but her head and across the lower part of her face was a bright yellow scarf. It failed, however, to hide her toothless gums. She invited the women of the party inside. The assistant must stay outside with the official spokesman. Mrs. Dorr explained it was not considered proper for strange men to enter a house where there were women. Animals occupied the ground floor, and the warm odors of their bodies and the sharp acid stink of urine and dung assailed me fiercely. Happily, we climbed some crude stairs to the second floor and went into a narrow, sparsely furnished sitting room. It was clean as a hospital. Even the floors, made of mud and then whitewashed, were spotless. The houses were always that way, Mrs. Dorr said. It was miraculous when you consider that they were fashioned. Mrs. Dorr knew all about it, but As I never expected to build a mud house, I'm afraid, I didn't pay too strict attention. First, you put up ridge poles, I believe, about a foot apart. But that could have been the second step. Ridge poles have to have something to rest on, don't they? And then across the ridge poles go willow branches that give the spring when the mud goes on. This type of construction naturally creates a heavy demand for willows. Whenever a child is born, Mrs. Dorr said, the farmer plants as many willows as he can afford. The woman of the house seated us on a hard cot beneath the front windows, and then, assisted by her daughter-in-law, whose buxom, sturdy body was covered from her chin to her bare feet with a peasant blouse and full bloomer-like pants, and whose head was wrapped in a pink scarf, served us a terrible tasting drink of yogurt mixed with water. Dutifully, we drank it, but our hostesses being Moslems, were observing Ramadan and could not touch it. I almost wished I were a Moslem. The old lady said she had not eaten since before dawn and would not eat again until after 8. Don't you find it difficult to fast for so many hours? I asked her, the Turkish woman in our party interpreting for me. No, God gives patience, she answered. Don't you lose weight? No, nothing happens, and nothing should. God provides, the old lady beamed. You see, put in Mrs. Dorr, they can eat all night if they so desire. But they have to sleep, I protested. Yes, those that work have to sleep, she admitted, which led to the revelation that in the olden days, that is, before Ataturk, very few Turks worked except the peasants. The Armenians and Greeks and Jews and other people that populated so much of the Ottoman Empire did the work while the Turks did the supervising. And no doubt, during Ramadan, they let the supervising slide, just as the peasants let the fields lie fallow. Now, worse luck, the Turks have no work, too. To give them sufficient strength for the day's labor, the meal before sunrise is most substantial. They have pilaf, the usual rice dish, cooked with oil and nuts, borek, made of layers and layers of very thin dough stuffed with cheese, ground up meat, liver, or whatever else is on hand, and fresh fruit cooked with sugar. After the sun goes down, the devout break their fast leisurely. They don't rush to the table and gobble up everything madly, as I would do, but begin ceremoniously, murmuring, with the permission of God, they drink a little water and eat one olive. Then they fall to. The old lady, Stars, I don't know why I insist on calling her old. She was the wife of the middle-aged-looking man who greeted us, but she was humped, and her brown face was finely cracked with patent leather shoes, and she gave off the feeling of ancientness. Said she no longer worked in the fields, but stayed at home to prepare the meals, make cheese, tend the vegetable garden, and care for the animals. I wish the day would soon come when all Turkish women could stay out of the fields, cried Mrs. Dorr. A blessed day it would be for Turkey. At this point, the men, flouting Moslem custom, eased themselves into the room, sat quickly on the floor near the door, and after a while joined the conversation. The village spokesman said he was the right-hand man of the town. He was the policeman, the night watchman, and the official greeter of guests, a regular Grover Whalen, I thought to myself. He and his three sons and son-in-law own 70 hectares, approximately 175 acres of land, which is considered a fairly good-sized farm in the Anatolian plateau section. They raise mostly barley and wheat. He and his wife also have 5 girls, but according to Mrs. Dorr, peasant Turks still don't count girls. Where the girls were, I never learned, but a shy 6 or 7 year old granddaughter with black hair and black eyes came in and half hid herself in the folds of the old lady's skirt. She's a dark one, said the grandmother casually, not pretty. Oh, I think she is pretty, I argued. She has to be fair and very plump to be pretty, Mrs. Dorr said to me in an aside. The Turks have always liked their women fat. They wanted them to weigh at least 200 pounds. This taste is slowly changing, but you still see, as I'm sure you've noticed, many more fat women than slender ones. The little girl brought a pair of bright pink store-bought socks for us to admire. Her grandfather had bought them for her in Ankara, and as she passed them about, I noticed the palms of her hands were hennaed. She's been having fun hennaing her palms like the grown-up women, Mrs. Dorr explained. It's like our children getting hold of our fingernail polish. When it was time to leave, Mrs. Dorr began to urge the old lady to come see her. I have to come see you. Now you must come see. I have come to see you. Now you must come see me. The old lady shook her head. Oh, yes, you must, caroled Mrs. Dorr. That is only fair. I come to see you. You come to see me. How do I know where you live? The old lady asked practically. Mrs. Dorr began to explain, and I began to walk down the stairs. In the stable part of the house, I glimpsed the daughter-in-law pitchforking manure. She had evidently come up the stairs only long enough to pass the yogurt drink. Her face was sweating and her clothes filthy. Outside, the boy was still shearing the sheep, and the wool still lay folded back before the door. On the mud roof of the house across the way, a stork stood on one foot, its nest of brush close by. The nest had fallen off the chimney, the official spokesman told me, and had broken the wing of the mama stork and had killed a baby stork. That was why the mama stood there looking so forlorn. Mrs. Dorr, catching up with me and hearing about the stork, grew very excited. She loves storks, she said, and is very moved by the Turk's deep regard for them. If a stork builds his nest on a chimney and stops up the chimney so it won't draw, the owners of the house don't move the nest, they build another chimney. There is a house in Ankara, she assured me solemnly, that has four chimneys solely because the stork stopped up the first three. She promised to show it to me when we returned to Ankara. But I began to think we weren't going to return to Ankara. Though it was now nearing 1 o'clock and Mrs. Dorr had invited the roommate and me to join her and Mr. Dorr at their home for lunch at that hour, there was another Ravli family we must visit. We strolled along the dirt road, came to a house more pretentious than that of the town greeter. It was of mud brick, plastered on the inside, and there were two stiff pieces of grass-green, velour-covered, blonde furniture in the front parlor. The woman of the house was proud of it and of her 100 hectares of land, but, like most capitalists, was angry with the government. It had drafted her son into the army. So what good is the land, she demanded, if there's no one to work it? Haven't you a husband, I asked. Oh, he is much too old, she answered bluntly. In the enclosed courtyard, Mrs. Dorr came upon one of the women who had visited her in Ankara. Crying out, they rushed into each other's arms, and then drawing out of the embrace, the Ravli woman asked, why didn't you get my son that job you promised me? Oh, what a moment. Poor Mrs. Dorr looked deflated. I turned away. It seemed more tactful, but I heard Mrs. Dorr stammering to the interpreter to tell the woman that she, Mrs. Dorr, hadn't understood about the job, her Turkish being so very inadequate. She was so sorry. The woman must come again to see her and tell her about the job. Arriving back in the center of the village, we heard the muezzin calling the people to prayer. He was standing on the slenderest, widest minaret above a doll-like mosque. With the permission of God, his high, sweet voice wafted over the bared hillsides, I call you to prayers. But no one heeded him that I could see. Most of the men of the village were congregated in a tiny blacksmith's shop half a block away. One customer, alighting from a donkey, displayed patches on his baggy pants of every piece of material woven in Anatolia, I'm sure. I tried to take a picture of him without his noticing me so that I could study it at leisure and try to pick out the original cloth. On the drive back to Ankara, we talked about the small, neatly laid out fields of wheat and barley and rye that roll softly away from the highway to the cloudless blue sky. They were honey-colored beneath the spillway of the sun. As Mrs. Dorr commented, the wide open spaces of Turkey are most paintable. I wish for my artist friends, Sally Brown and Martin Schallenberger. And the land close to Ankara not only looked beautiful, but prosperous. More water has a lot to do with it, and so has the help given to the peasants by ECA in the past 4 years. Ravli and 22 other villages of that area belong to an organization that has a technical agricultural assistant, an agricultural teacher, a tractor, a cultivator, and one complete set of agricultural tools. Besides, there are now 15 privately owned tractors. 3 years ago, there was only one. The increasing use of tractors and cultivators in a land that has been accustomed for centuries to the wooden plow and water buffalo has necessitated a terrific step up in the Turks' knowledge of machinery. This hasn't been easy. The ECA has 7 mobile units that travel about the country teaching the peasants in the field and the children in schools how to care for and repair farm machinery. The whole of Turkey's population, according to Mrs. Dorr, is pretty much lower middle class, and in spite of Ataturk and his reforms, they still have a long, long way to come. Entering Ankara, we were conscious of innumerable soldiers and civilians in the street. The city seemed alarmingly restless. "What's going on?" I asked. "The statue of Ataturk has been defaced, as you perhaps heard," the ECA assistant answered. "Yes, I've heard. Well, there are to be some exercises this afternoon at the foot of the monument. Government officials and other groups will lay wreaths to demonstrate to the people their affection for Ataturk. The ceremony is in the nature of a protest." "Oh, I must lay a wreath too," explained Mrs. Dorr. "I couldn't possibly let such an occasion pass without showing my heartfelt appreciation of Kemal Ataturk. The Turkish people wouldn't understand if I didn't lay a wreath. They know how tremendously I admire him. I have spoken to them about him many times. Oh, I must order flowers immediately." Then, addressing the driver, she said, "Please go to that little florist shop where I always get flowers. It is late, but I'm sure they will fix up something for me. They must. They really must." We reached the little shop, and Mrs. Dorr sailed in. She was gone for some little time, but when she returned, she had everything in hand. She had discarded the wreath idea, and there would be too many wreaths. Instead, the florist was going to arrange a sheaf of white flowers. She could pick it up on the way to the ceremony. Mr. Dorr, the roommate, and another gentleman were waiting for us when we reached the Dorr's house just an hour and a half late. I shook in my shoes at the flash in the roommate's blue eyes, but not Mrs. Dorr. Waving to them gaily, she went upstairs and washed her hair. Yes, her hair. And then she came down about 15 minutes later and joined the men and me on the lawn. It was soaking wet, but curling beautifully, all over the top of her head like Mary Martin's in South Pacific. Gosh, how I resented her. I couldn't possibly sit down to lunch after those dusty roads and that dusty village without first shampooing my hair, she said sweetly to the gentleman. I hope you don't mind. Not at all, they said, and the roommate spoke even louder than the rest. On the lawn beneath us, an almond tree in full fruit, we had as perfect a lunch as I ever ate. Now and then I'd lean back and pluck an almond and munch it just to show I could. As we were nearing the dessert, the roommate was called to the phone. He came back grinning. It was the ambassador, and he wanted to know if the roommate had fallen in a well. He was supposed to play golf with him at 3 o'clock, and now, of course, it was after that hour. I stayed with Mrs. Dorr to go with her to the graduation exercises of some young Turkish nurses. Mrs. Dorr said she was very concerned about the tragic shortage of nurses in Turkey and had been trying to correct the matter. In the last 6 months, 200 women had been graduated in home nursing, and now this afternoon another group was to receive pins. Mrs. Dorr felt she simply had to be there, but unfortunately we lingered so long over lunch and over the lovely things, many of them gifts in the Dorr's house, and over getting ready, Mrs. Dorr wanted to change into something cool and fresh, that we reach the exercises only in time to see the nurses, with their candles burning, marching off the platform. But Mrs. Dorr was there to shake each nurse's hand and to have her picture taken with her group by a photographer of the local press, and to have some cakes and punch. This over, we tore back to the doors to meet a small group of Turkish businessmen and a very young blonde American girl from Memphis, Tennessee, who was fasting during Ramadan for newspaper copy. Can you imagine? She said she was so thirsty some days she was tempted to cheat when she cleaned her teeth by letting a little water trickle down her throat, but so far she had overcome this base temptation. My one reaction was that I hoped I was never that hard up for a coffee. The Turkish businesswomen seemed unusually pleasant and intelligent, and they spoke excellent English, but there was no time to talk, for the hour of the laying of the wreaths on Ataturk's statue had come, and Mrs. Dorr, of course, had to be there. The guests said they understood perfectly. In fact, they would like to accompany her. Excitedly, we piled into two cars, picked up the sheaf, which was of white gladioli and enormous, and headed for the statue. But alas and alack, we were late again. The wreaths were all laid, and the speeches, if there had been any, all said. But there were still hundreds of people milling about the statue, reading the banners across the wreaths and admiring the flowers. There were really too many people, Mrs. Dorr said. She would feel so conspicuous making her way through all those people and putting her sheaf down with everybody looking at her. Then, too, there might be photographers still lingering about. Finally, though, she said she would do it if one of the Turkish women would go with her. That way she wouldn't feel quite so conspicuous. So the two of them proceeded through the crowd, Mrs. Dorr leading the way and the Turkish woman following with the flowers. When they reached the base of the statue, Mrs. Dorr turned, smiled radiantly at her companion, took the flowers from her, and laid them ever so gently upon the grass. It was a pretty sight, and a good one, I decided to leave on. After that, anything would be anticlimax. End of chapter 12.